And welcome to Sustainable Sustainability, a series of podcasts brought to you by the Stewardship Asia Centre. I'm Tamer Nabili, co-hosting alongside Rajiv Peshwaria, who is the CEO of the Stewardship Asia Centre. Hi, Rajiv.
Hi, Tamer. And I am really delighted today because we have a very special guest on our show today, an old friend and somebody who is the epitome of sustainable sustainability, none other than Sir Robert Swan. Welcome, Rob, to the show.
Great to be here, gentlemen.
Rob, we've worked off and on together for the last 20 years, and it's really been an amazing privilege to see your journey. So I have a lot of questions today for you. But let me start with a quote of yours. Many of your quotes are very famous now, but there's one that is everywhere. And you also very kindly use that to endorse the book, Sustainable Sustainability. The greatest threat to our planet is the belief that someone else will save it.
Actually, I have to say, Rajiv, I'm very proud that I'm above all the recycling bins and rubbish bins in, I think, the Marina Bay Sands complex, and often say to people, that's where I should be, in the trash. But really where that comes from is mindset. And I think so many people today all know that our climate is changing, that we're under threat. But for some extraordinary reason, they genuinely believe that they can just carry on living their lives as they always lived them, and that by magic somehow, somebody else will change everything. So I really believe firmly that one's got to look at oneself on all these issues and realize that somebody else isn't going to sort it out. We have to. And that's where that came from.
But, you know, you go around today, the word sustainability comes up about 20 times a day in a normal course of the day. And they say that the younger generation now is very, very aware and is taking responsibility because it's their future at stake. And you're saying, yeah, but it's actually not happening?
Well, not really, no. I think that it's very arrogant of us more senior people on the planet just to say, oh, well, we've messed everything up. Young people can sort it out. And that's not the case. Young people are feeling very much, as you know, come on, you and I know this. Young people are feeling very vulnerable. They're not stupid. They have all these social media things, and most of that is negative. So it's Dubai's flooding, Russia's flooding, Singapore's too hot, and we're all going to die if it gets much hotter. Those are the messages that are coming out to young people. And I think that it's really, really important that we have a drive towards giving them hope. Because if we end up with a hopeless generation, it won't be sorted out. Because these people, as we well know, we've known each other for 20 years and it seems like 5 minutes. So where are these young people going to be in 20 years? So we've got to make absolutely sure that they're part of the solution, not the problem.
What about those people who are not young people? I mean, my generation, baby boomers and Generation X people, such a massive cohort of them think the same way. I mean, at least the young people have, it seems, a degree of commitment and a degree of drive to do something about it. Whereas I know a whole bunch of people of my generation who are either indifferent to the whole thing or in absolute denial.
Yes, it's a very difficult thing. And it's actually quite annoying, bluntly. That people do believe, again, that they can just carry on as they are. And they think, oh, well, I'll buy an electric car and that'll sort it all out. And I've ticked off my sustainability thing and I'm really good. Or, as you know, Rajiv, a big corporation makes a big statement and says, we are going to be carbon zero by 2049. Well, that's complete nonsense, because all the people that are there are probably going to retire or die by then. And I think a lot of people that you're talking about, people of our generation, sort of believe, well, the companies are going to do it. The government's got this brand new legislation that's going to sort everything out and that we're okay. But I think that increasingly people are not feeling okay because they're getting slapped in the face by climate. I can guarantee you that if we went to Dubai tomorrow and started talking a bit more about sustainability, people would listen more because they just got slammed. And I think that is a big issue, that people don't seem to want to act, but they really maybe should look differently and work out that they're privileged people. There's no one listening to this program now who's starving. So most people who are listening are privileged. So what are you doing with that privilege? Have you really worked out the carbon footprint of your family? Are you just willy-nilly flying around the planet, doing all these incredible things, ticking off the bucket list? I mean, when people say that to
you're
me...
You're making me feel guilty.
I have not a lot to say. So I think it's thinking about your actions, your home, your energy, your influence. And anybody who's listening has influence. Mm. Use it.
So you decided a long time ago to practice what you preach and do something about it. And having been the first person in history to have walked both the poles, take us back to when you first decided to walk the pole the first time. What was the motivation behind doing it the first time?
Well, it's funny actually, because I've been thinking about that a lot recently when I've been speaking to young people, which I do every day. And this began for me because I had anxiety. And I had anxiety because when I was growing up, the Soviet Union was likely to throw a lot of missiles towards Britain and the United States, and the United States was going to respond with lots of missiles back. And according to calculations when I was 11, the whole world would blow up 3,000 times if all the missiles went off at the same time. And as a kid, I thought, well, that's a bit odd. Surely once is enough to blow up the planet. And then with that feeling, I saw Antarctica literally on a film, and I thought, wow, here's a place which no one owns, there's no wars, I'm going there. So it started with something that was anxiety about the future, and I think those words never existed until recently amongst young people, that they actually have climate anxiety. And if, you know, in our world, if if people are frightened, they don't do anything. If people are just passive and say, oh, well, somebody else will sort it out, nothing happens. So we have to kind of work between those things. And I think that's what your book is wonderful about, is that we have to show leadership. We can't just sit back or be terrified. We have to actually step forward and show leadership on this issue. And it's really key. And it starts with ourselves.
When you did go there, and I think you achieved your double goal in the late 80s, right? When you were down there, what did you see? Because for so many young people, and indeed for so many people in general, they seem to think that climate change is something that's just come along and its effects will be many, many decades down the line. But back in the 80s, were you aware that there was a problem?
No. I went to the North Pole because it went down well with girls at parties. I did not go there to save the planet or do anything. I just wanted to go to the pole to be the first, respect the history of Scott Amundsen and Shackleton. That was it. So I never thought about it. But on the way to the South Pole, we walked under a hole in the ozone layer, which we didn't know was there. It was discovered while we were walking. And my eyes burnt out, my face fried off. Got back home to be told, oh, by the way, just walked under a hole in the ozone layer, which is man-made through CFC gases. And I thought, wow, that's what happened to us. And I made an effort to try and do something about it, and no one listened. We then went to the North Pole, walking off across a frozen ocean of ice, and the whole ice cap melted beneath our feet, which had never happened before in recorded Arctic history. So we all nearly drowned. So at both poles, I came back thinking, wow, I need to do something about this.
And how do you feel now that, you know, we hear that last winter was the worst situation for Arctic ice, Antarctic ice in history, and the melting is going much worse than we ever feared?
Well, I think as my great friend Ben Horton of the Earth Observatory says, you know, the clock's ticking and we're not listening. It's tick, tock, tick, tock. And all that ice, you can't walk to the North Pole anymore. There's no ice there. So I might be the first person in history to walk to both poles. I could end up being the last because you can't walk there. The Antarctic is certainly melting. I go there every year. These are things that are happening, and it's gradual. It's not going to suddenly come. Well, I hope not. It's not going to suddenly come. But I feel that what we have to do is say, these places are trying to tell us something, we need to listen. But people have been saying that for 30 years. What I like about what Rajiv's saying is, okay, we know the score, this is what we should do. He's talking about business, he's talking about leadership, I'm talking about people actually who are listening, stopping for a moment and saying, okay, what's my contribution to this problem? We're building walls around Singapore at $100 billion worth of walls, I think it is. Will that be enough? And what about places that can't build walls? So it's we've got to be positive, we've got to be hopeful, but also at the same time know that if we're not willing to transition, we need to stand aside and let somebody else do that.
So you went to the North and the South Pole and you realized that something needed to be done. Since then to now, tell us a little bit about the journey as to what you've been doing to address the issue of environmental sustainability.
Well, one's got to know, and I think we met round about that time, is that when you talked about all these things 30 years ago, I was put in the box of being a radical green activist, just because I was talking about holes in the ozone and that we'd walked across ice caps that were melting. So at the beginning, and it's very strange, Rajiv, that at the beginning I realised that I couldn't talk about these things because no one would want to listen because they just didn't. I was a greenie. So I realised, as you've realised over the years, that the best thing for me to talk about was leadership. So I started this journey talking about leadership, and then at the end of my talks, putting a little bit in about sustainability and the environment. And that's gradually increased. But interestingly enough, it hasn't changed. Because what people ask me now to do, and you do, and that's why we work together so well, is it's still down to leadership. But it's leadership on sustainability now, as well as normal leadership. Our journey has been varied, because in the middle of all this, I was given a 50-year mission to protect Antarctica, or try to protect Antarctica, by Jacques Cousteau. We've been working on that for 33 years. And young people love that. When I say to them, in 17 years' time, 2041, the world is going to decide on the future of the Antarctic, please remember this talk I'm giving you today. So when you're 34 or whatever age you're going to be, don't forget we need to preserve Antarctica. So it's been positive. It's been hopeful, because I learnt walking to the poles that if you're not positive, you die.
So, sorry, what happens in 2041?
In 2041, the agreements that preserve Antarctica, right now we all own it. It's the only place in the world that we all own. And in 2041, the agreements can start to fall to bits. And we could be stupid enough to destroy the only place in the world that we all own.
You think that might happen? I mean, the Madrid Agreement that set 2041 as the date, you know, even before that, Antarctica was generally seen as a place for common ownership of I mean, no one nation owns it. Right? So do you really think that would reverse? And do you think anyone is actually going to be allowed to go and drill explore that?
Russia just invaded Ukraine. So I don't feel that one can stop things. But I think I'm approaching that in 2041. The Madrid Protocol comes up for review. And we could be stupid enough to think that we go there, no one owns it, to destroy the last great wilderness left on Earth, which should be the place that is telling us what we're doing to the planet. It is the world's greatest scientific resource. And how you save it, which I've been working on for 33 years, is twofold. One is to make it not financially worth going there. So how do you do that? You try and make sure that we're using enough renewable energy in the real world that it won't make financial sense to go and exploit Antarctica. Second, massive focus on young people. And we just launched a really, really cool 5 to 11-year-old education program about Antarctica, all about penguins. They go crazy. They love penguins. But the mindset is that an 11-year-old is going to be pushing on 27, 28 in 2041, so we want them to remember looking after Antarctica. All positive, nothing negative, and getting that idea of leadership in. How are you leading yourself?
So when it comes to leadership, a word you've used several times already, one of the things we're talking about in business is that, you know, we need to find innovative solutions to problems of the environment, problems of climate change, right? Innovation means you fail 8 out of 10 times. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the key is to not give up and remain resilient. Now, what can you tell us about resilience based on your journeys to the poles, multiple journeys to the poles, and what did you learn about how to sort of fortify that resilience?
It's tricky, Rajiv. As you know, I walked to both poles. I got there when I was 33, and that was it. I was never going to walk anywhere ever again, ever. Done. And my son Barney, who's doing some great work as a young person in the rainforest in far north Queensland, Australia, replanting actually part of the oldest rainforest on the planet, he convinced his father to go out and finish a journey that I'd sort of forgotten about, which was to complete the crossing of the whole of the Antarctic landmass. And
just to put that in context, that's pretty much coast to coast US mainland, isn't it?
It's a long way, yeah. Very long way. But I'd done a lot of it already. So he convinced me to go back. We did it on renewable energy. And I thought, being rather arrogant, well, I could do it. You know, if you're the first person to walk to both poles, you've got this. Although I was in my early 60s, which was the mistake. And halfway to the pole, 300 clicks in, Rajiv, my hip disintegrated. And I couldn't walk at all. And so I had to fail. And I think resilience has to do with dealing with failure, actually. And I have failed in everything in life, certainly financially, as you know, but I failed in everything, but I never failed to get to the pole when I said I was going to get there. So this failure, leaving my son at 23 and to complete the journey, which he did, this was a massive thing. And it really hit me hard. And I think I learned a lot. At the time, it was hard. But I learned a lot from that failure about being resilient and also helping other people. I'm an Englishman and I was brought up to be very stiff upper lip and never say anything about how you feel or inside stuff. And I had to. So got back from that expedition, Barney reached the pole, carried on, and I went again to finish those last 300 miles to cross Antarctica. And 97 miles from the pole, my brand new hip, I made a mistake, and it blew out of its socket. Completely.
This was in your second attempt?
Yeah, second attempt to finish the crossing of the Antarctic. And I was carted out from the pole. And again, I'd now failed twice at the very thing I was supposed to be the best in the world at doing. And it was really painful. And it's cost a lot of money to do these things. So I got back home and I thought, damn it, got to finish it. So at the beginning of 2023, Barney and I went back and finished those last miles to the South Pole. Took 37 years to cross Antarctica. But I think in that journey of resilience, I think understanding how other people feel during failure is an important part of leadership. Most of my life, if somebody was having a rough time or failing, I'd be the sort of person to say, pull yourself together and carry on. But I think those journeys...
All parents would relate to that.
Yeah, but I think I learned a hell of a lot and had to dig deep. So deeper than I ever have to make that a success, the journey.
So most people would give up after those many failures. And, you know, the odds were against you. The advice was against you. You're a 60-something-year-old man. What are you trying to do? Are you crazy? And you say that you wanted to go back yet again. So where did that resilience come from? Why?
Well, I think in this life, we've only got one life.
We all do, yeah.
This time round. And we're on a planet in the middle of a universe that goes on forever. And according to present information, there's no one out there for a really long way. So you've got one life, and I could not justifiably say I was going to do something and not do it. But on a more personal note, I wasn't going to look at a map of Antarctica, which I do every day, and think for the rest of my life that there were those 300 miles to go or the last 97 miles to go. It had to be done. And I'm proud that we did it, and my son and I did it together, because you're right. At 67, you should not be out there. You're an old man at 35 in my business. So I really got smashed up doing it, and it was very hard.
There was clearly a bigger purpose behind it. You just didn't do it because it had to be done, and just because you said you were going to do it.
The purpose was to finish the job. Because, I wasn't going to look at a map of Antarctica, and there was this small gap of not having done it. And even at 67, I felt I could do it. But at 77 or 87 or 97 or even 107, my mum died last year at 106, so you never know, I wouldn't be able to do it. So there was that question. And I think also a question of young people going through a rough time. People underestimate how rough it is to be a young person today with all this communications coming in from everywhere and most of it's negative. So I felt that I could do something that was breaking through not being able to do it or people saying I couldn't do it. So I felt there was more issues, but in bottom line is I said I was going to do it and we were bloody well going to finish it.
So how does that translate into our challenge today? I mean, everything you said relates to the initial conception that you put forward, which is mindset. And it also maps on to the challenge of climate change and trying to cultivate that sort of resilience in the current generations and trying to cultivate a sense of agency in those young people to get up and do something rather than sit back and go, well, someone else will take care of it. How do we infuse that into the people?
A tricky business because, as you rightly said earlier, it's not just young people, it's our generation as well that need to be infused with action and leadership, especially in their corporate roles on this issue. And that's one issue, and I think Rajiv's book pretty much nails that bit. From young people's point of view, they just want to feel that in their own way, they can make a difference. They're feeling frozen. They're feeling, what are we going to do? It's all getting worse. No one's telling us what to do. What do we do with the rest of our lives? What jobs are we going to get? How do we do it? Where are we going to live? It's quite difficult for them. But as I say, you can think about everything, a bit like our generation. What are you doing? You know, most young people don't realize that every time they take 426 selfies and put all this information on the cloud, that the cloud just sort of exists up there in the air. It's in a flipping data center, and data centers require power. So, you know, why not have 5 million selfies, just have 50 that you really like and might use? Don't just take it for granted that all this stuff you do is free and that it's not being paid for somewhere from an energy point of view. And thinking about green jobs, you know, maybe they can start a company. Action. And at the moment, they're kind of a bit frozen. So I think thinking about what they're doing, maybe kicking butt with their family a bit more to say, hey, what are we doing as a family is an important thing. And I think also that they feel hopeful. Because without hope, especially in my business, you die.
You've been taking these expeditions to Antarctica. A lot of people I know have gone on them. Tell us a little bit about that. What are you doing there? What are you trying to achieve there?
Well, first and foremost, if you're trying to preserve Antarctica, which I'm doing, going there on a ship and using oil and people flying there does have an environmental impact. So first and foremost, we make absolutely sure that we come out net positive on the carbon, and we do that through planting trees with my son Barney in the rainforest in Australia. It's important to at least say that, because people sometimes say, well, if you're trying to save it, why go there? So what we've been doing for 20 odd years is to sort of gradually move in the right direction. The overall theme is to become champions for Antarctica and help preserve it forever. The second most important thing is leadership. The third is sustainability. So at last, after, you know, I'm not very well organized, as you know, Rajiv, but I'm sort of getting there. At the end of 2025, we're launching Allies for Sustainability, because you and I have just been to this amazing conference here in Singapore. We go to these conferences. People join together. They make these bonds, and then they all go back home and become separate again. So I would like to take, and will take, people like yourself and lots of other people. Ben Horton's coming from the Earth Observatory. Get really good leaders down there to put their cards on the table about sustainability and about leadership. Have some wonderful support people who are there, behavioral scientists, all those sort of people, to come away with a shared experience and a bond, which you get in Antarctica, trust me, because you just have to look out the window, and then come home and keep sharing, keep that bond going on sustainability and leadership and ideas. Get the ideas. This is what we've been doing, and I'm going to take oil companies and gas companies and mining companies. We need to get together on this. And then over the next 9 years, which I reckon, you know, according to science, we've got about 9 years to get our act together on all of this. Over the next 9 years, have another Allies for Sustainability expedition, either to Antarctica or to the Arctic or to the rainforest. So it keeps that bond going between people. But overall, the clock's ticking on Antarctica. It'll be 17, 16, 15, 14 years until 2041. That's the plan.
Just want to bring up, actually, something relevant to that point. I mean, how do you keep people in touch with each other beyond the conference circuit? And Stewardship Commons, the website that the Stewardship Asia Centre has set up, I think is exactly an expression of that. You get people to contribute and commune together on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll walk you through it later, but it's like Wikipedia. So it's crowdsourced. Anybody anywhere in the world can contribute. Anybody anywhere in the world can consume. And it's a site that we're hoping that this becomes the world's largest melting pot for people to connect on issues of sustainability.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I think add that friendship, because when you go to Antarctica, you create a bond. And I have people that went 20 years ago that are still annoying me in contact, writing letters. This is way before WhatsApp or Zoom or Skype. And they're still saying to me, Rob, you're not doing enough. Can you get this? Could you send this letter? So Antarctica creates a bond between people that lasts. So add what you're doing to the bond of people, you've got a winner.
And we'll cover it live on the 2025 expedition on Stewardship Commons. How's that, Tim Wolf?
That sounds like a great idea. Streaming it live. No, well, it's going to be a Chatham House affair, but there, we can create content.
Exactly. You are. You said you were going to Antarctica again to live for 2 months in a hut, totally on renewable energy, and talk to a billion people from there. What's behind that? What are you trying to achieve there?
Clock's ticking all round. So clock's ticking on our survival on the planet, clock's ticking on preserving Antarctica. And I think it's very important to do things where you can explain without having to speak for hours. So I'm going to this hut at 80 degrees south in Antarctica. It's called Ice Station, so it'll get the young people a bit more interested. And first and foremost, using Starlink, which is a good communications tool, be able to get teachers behind our 5 to 11 year old education program on the preservation of Antarctica. So I'll be speaking a lot with schools, recording things for schools and sending it out from Antarctica, showing the kids, because they all want to know, how are you going to go to the loo? What's going to happen to your poo? What happens to your wee? How are you going to make a cup of tea? How are you going to sleep? Will you be, all those issues they love. So I'll be showing them all of those things and explaining that, yes, I'm living on renewable energy, but the sun doesn't shine all the time. So what am I going to do? Freeze? No. I'm going to start my generator, and the generator's running on biofuel or fuel made from CO2 that we put into the atmosphere, showing kids about this energy transition, which I think is a very important part of being a leader, to say, hey, it's not all going to happen in 5 minutes, but this is how the transition works. By the end of 2025, a lot of young people are going to be wearing Apple Vision goggle things. I mean, that's going to be the future, whether we like it or not. So I'd like to be able to get to sort of late teens, early 20s, with, again, some really positive messages on leadership and hope and how they're going to run their lives. But again, using the Antarctic as a backdrop for those stories. So communications exercise, no walking allowed, well, not very far, but no going to the South Pole on foot. Otherwise, my son Barney would come to Antarctica and kill me because those days are over. He can't deal with his father doing any more of that cold weather walking.
So. And surely the last thing we want is to replicate the Everest situation, where there is now such a forest of people trying to get to that point.
That is, Leave No Trace is a fantastic part of Antarctic travel. And people are very, very good in that direction, that people, you know, the last 60 miles to the South Pole, you have to carry your poo and wee, and it's really good. You go to Everest and it's absolutely disgusting. All these wealthy people go up there to tick a box to say they've climbed Everest, and they're just leaving an absolutely disgusting mess. I think that if people want to make money, they should have a lot extra money charged to go and do it, and that extra money should be to clean Everest. If I wasn't 67 years of age and I was 33, I would be mounting a massive expedition every year to go and clean up Everest. I just, you know, Antarctica is enough for me, but that really does grind me. And I was privileged to know Sir Edmund Hillary, and him and Tenzing made it to the summit first. And when you talk to him, even 20 years ago, he was appalled that people could go there and just leave such a mess. And no problem in people going to climb it. That's not a problem. It's leaving the mess that's an issue.
It's so amazing to watch your story. And I've watched it, as I said, for over two decades. And the ability to inspire young people. And must be a really proud thing for you to have inspired your own son, right? Because you can inspire other people's sons and daughters, but it's very hard to inspire your own. But he's walking in your footsteps and more. How does that feel?
Well, it feels very good. And you asked a question earlier, how does one inspire young people? My mum gave me some very good advice, knowing that I was an impossible human being. She said, Rob, if you want Barney to do anything that you're doing, let him decide himself. Don't push him. If he wants to become a ballet dancer, a dentist, a doctor, a lawyer, just let him do it. Don't push him, because if you push him, he'll never do it. So I just shut up. And Barney came to me about 5 or 6 years ago and said, Dad, look, we're really angry, our generation, with your generation, Dad. Not grandmum's generation, your generation, because you people have known what you've been doing and you haven't done enough. And he said, well, that's how we feel, but I'd like to be part of doing positive things for young people, because we're feeling a bit hopeless. And as you all know, people, young people especially, will be going like this on their phones and being very angry against governments and companies and industry and business, and that gets them more likes, so they're all happy. But that's not going to get us anywhere. So Barney started his mission in Australia, which is to replant the oldest rainforest on the planet. And he had to do it on his own, because I've got no money. He's got my support. But he did it on his own because, again, any parents listening, that if you're a strong human being, then it's very hard to be your son or daughter. So back off a bit and let people get on with it and make mistakes. Don't micromanage the whole thing. And Barney's done it. He's creating a blueprint in his rainforest where he's replanting the oldest rainforest in the world. And he's creating a blueprint again on leadership for forests in need in Southeast Asia. Because people don't cut down the forest for exercise. They do it because it's a living. So he's trying to show people that you can make good business out of not cutting down the rainforest. So, yeah, I'm very proud of Barney, but pride's easy to say. I'm impressed.
Very good, very good. I mean, what I'm taking away is if you want to inspire people, inspire them with your action, not with your words.
Correct.
But in practical terms, I mean, your own children are a different kettle of fish, obviously. they respond differently to input. But we do need, as we said earlier on, to act upon mindsets. And we do need to inspire people to action now, because action is necessary. How do we do that? How do you advise, and what are you doing to help people to get active and to make a difference?
Well, I think you can't do things on your own. That's for sure. So you have to join with the right people. Here I am with you both today. That's the type of thing I like to do, is to support other people who are doing something that I couldn't do. And what you're doing here, what you're doing, Rajiv, I couldn't be doing, but you can. So supporting people that you trust, who've got it right and are talking possibly about things that I wouldn't understand, but I'm behind it. Second is that it's just that turning of the dial. And with young people, and I've spoken to a lot of schools, I speak to schools every day, and if somebody's got a check for $1 million and I had all my bills covered, that's all I'd ever do, is speak to teenage young people, 17, 18 years of age, because they're important. And with them, with the younger people, how is actually to first say it's not a complete disaster. So don't switch off. So one, give them some hope. And two, say, look, you can make a difference in this. You're about to start your life. You're going to college. You're going to university. You don't have to be some green person. Just live your life with a sustainable feeling to it. So we all make choices on cost and how annoying something is to do, and we have normal things that we make decisions on in life. Well, just put sustainability and the environment on that list. So when you buy something, think about it. Who's made it? Where does it come from? If you're going on an airline, what's the airline doing that's right? If it's all greenwashed, don't fly with them. If you feel they're really doing something, go for it. You know, clean up. That's a good point. I think offsetting has become a very easy cop-out for people. Mm. Oh, well, we've signed a check. Offset. If you make a mess, you should clean it up. And I think clean-up is a very good way to inspire especially young people to say, look, you are going to make a bit of a mess. You're doing all this stuff on iCloud, and you're doing this, you're doing that. Have a thought about how you could clean it up, I think is inspiring to them. So with young people, it's hope, inspiration, getting them out, getting them part of something. And then the more senior people of business people, work with people like Rajiv, work with people like you. I was very proud to meet Ravi Menon the other day, who is now the new climate ambassador here for Singapore. He's a hell of a good guy. He's on it. He's excited. Support other people.
You know, you're trying to unite the world towards a common cause, which is, in this case, Antarctica and sustainability in general. You're trying to encourage all of us to work across boundaries, work across cultures, come together, something in a humble way we are trying to do as well. But what do you have to say to the political leaders in many countries today who are doing exactly the opposite, dividing us to stay in power?
I think what's important to remember, that unless you're in a dictatorship, one does have a vote. And I live in the United States of America, and it's very, very divided. So rather than saying, oh, well, I'm just going to go and give a speech in Democratic Central, I say, no, I want to go and speak in the middle of the Rust Belt. I want to go and speak to people who don't believe a damn word that I'm saying. So try and, rather than fight things, cross some boundaries. Go and actually speak to the people that don't want to hear you, that possibly are being inspired not to hear this message, for whatever reason it is, I don't know, and not just say, isn't it all terrible? You know, all we're going to hear in the next 6 months is, oh my God, the world's going to end because Donald Trump might become the president of the United States of America. all negative, negative, negative. But how about saying, well, maybe I should go and speak to a couple of people that vote for him and try and cross those divides rather than just putting everything in a box and moaning about it. I would say to people that don't really have a say in it, so they're living underneath a regime where they don't have a say in it, to keep trying, not to give up, because it doesn't matter what regime you're under, climate change is going to affect everybody. Quite interesting, a couple of weeks ago, worst floods ever in Russia. That woke up a few people. Dubai flooded yesterday. So I think it's a really difficult question, but rather than moaning about it, try and go over the other side and influence and talk to people that don't want to hear us.
Well, thank you for inspiring us today, Rob, and I hope your work with the young people bears some fruit. Good luck with the 2041 Foundation.
Well, thank you, and thanks. This has been great.
Thank you for joining us.
All the best.
Awesome. Thanks very much.